Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Hagi Madhubuti and Ishmael Reed, among the headliners at this weekend's Black Arts Movement 2016 conference at Dillard University. We'll also hear from Ken Foster, celebrating 10 years of The Dogs Who Found Me. Professor Hagi Madhubuti is a poet, lecturer, publisher, and member of the Black Arts Movement. He'll be giving the keynote address at the Black Arts Movement Conference 2016 at Dillard University September 9th. In addition to his own considerable body of work, nearly 30 books, Professor Madhubuti is the founder, publisher, and chairman of the board of Third World Press, which has been in existence since 1967. It is the largest Black-owned independent publishing company in the United States. He was born Don Luther Lee in Little Rock, Arkansas, but took his Swahili name in 1974. Hagi means justice, and Madhubuti means precise, accurate, and dependable. Professor Madhubuti, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm really happy to be with you all.
It's so wonderful that you're coming to New Orleans. This conference is such a big deal. So first off, would you describe for us the Black Arts Movement and its place in your life?
Well, it's pivotal in my life. The Black Arts Movement kicked off nationally in 1965 after the assassination of Malcolm X. And Malcolm X was kind of the patriot father of most of us at that time who were young, very young, and involved in black struggle. In many ways, just like Black Lives Matter today, that we were fighting for the same goals and objectives. But as artists, as poets, as writers, as visual artists, as photographers, as musicians, as actors, and whatever the case may be, we felt that essentially it's our time to stand up. And what is very clear to us was that we had to begin to redefine ourselves. And in redefining ourselves, first and foremost, we had to agree, most certainly regionally or nationally, about the question each of us asks us, who am I? Okay, who am I in the context of this body, in the context of this struggle, this culture? Who am I in terms of where we are going as a people? And my position has always been, if you do not know who you are, anybody can name you, and they will. And so it was around redefinition. So we ceased being Negroes, and we became black people. We became African Americans. We became people of African ancestry. And so in each of the regions around the country, you had these local initiatives that began to build. And I, as a poet, I was fortunate enough to build on the initiatives that have been created around my time, and most certainly the DuSable Museum of African American History in Chicago, which I was one of the early workers there. The Broadside Press out of Detroit, Michigan, with the great poet Dudley Randall. I haven't been mentored also by not only Dudley Randall, but Hort W. Fuller, who was the managing editor of Negro Digest Black World Magazine, the major publishing vehicle to come out of the Black Arts Movement, as well as Barbara Ann Sizemore, one of the major national educators, who was the first black superintendent of the D.C. school district, and, of course, the great, great Pulitzer Prize-winning Gwendolyn Brooks. These people mentored me. And so I, along with men and women across the country, artists across the country, began to locally build, regionally build, nationally build institutions. And in our work, we began to essentially reflect the direction we felt that black people need to go as we move forward into the, actually this was in the 60s, so as we moved into the 70s, 80s, and beyond. And so the Black Arts Movement was the kind of the cultural, intellectual body of artistic works coming from all the various art forms that gave us a fundamental understanding of ourselves, of the people who we are fighting against, of the direction in which we needed to go, and just as importantly, in redefining the world as we saw it and as we see it today.
Well, your work has been so important in providing such enduring, what I call literary infrastructure for the African American community. I mean, Third World Press has been so important. Black Books Bulletin, all those things. And you founded so many institutions that have been so enduring, you know, like the Institute of Positive Education, the New Concept Development Center. I mean, how has that work in the community as an activist informed your writing life? Because you have balanced giving so much that you've given to the community with your own creative life.
Well, none of this would have happened if I had not been a poet. That's first and foremost. If I had not been an artist, none of this would have happened. Primarily because I needed a vehicle to be heard. And so poetry became that vehicle, number one. Number two, I decided to work primarily in the Black community because I didn't see too many other people doing this kind of work. I was the first Black poet in residence at Cornell University in 1968-69. No other Black poet had been at Ivy League University. But that taught me about institutional white supremacy and white nationalism at the highest level. All too often, we want to blame the skinheads and the right-wing Aryan movement. But white supremacy and racism and nationalism, white nationalism, exists in the universities at the highest level. And I could not have found that out or realized that if I had not taught at Cornell University at such a young age. I was 25, 26 years old. And so being a poet and understanding that and trying to translate it in my work was very critical. But I got that kind of dedication to this at a serious level from Dudley Randall and Gwendolyn Brooks and Margaret Burroughs and Shelley Burroughs and Hort Fuller and Barbara Sizemore. These were my mentors. Now, so for me, the major criteria for this kind of work, the number one criteria was not the craft and learning how to write. The number one criteria to do this kind of work was you have to love yourself and you have to love Black people. This is so critical because I think that when you love Black people, whatever is thrown at you to say that, you know, all people are like this and, all, you know, that's not true. That the only people who have suffered as much as Black people in this nation are the indigenous so-called Native Americans or quote-unquote Indians whom the Europeans came in and nearly extinguished. I mean, this is the first genocide in terms of Native Americans. And so I understand that history, and I'm not confused. As a result of that, I had to essentially make some very difficult decisions. And understand, there's a difference between making a decision and making a choice.
Yes,
people
there
make
is.
Choices all the time. They make choices within the parameters of other people's decisions. My decision was to go back to the Black community and to live there and work to build these institutional structures. Now, I had to earn a living, and I decided to earn a living working in the university level. So I ended up going to MFA at the University of Iowa. I mean, it's a story behind all of this stuff, teaching at Iowa. But I had spent 26 years at Chicago State University. I used to teach at Howard University. But because I did not want to leave Chicago, I commuted every week between Chicago and D.C.
Boy, now that's a price to pay. That's hard work.
All
you have to do is hear a story like that one of you reading Richard Wright's Black Boy. I mean, that moment when you connect with a writer makes all the difference in a life, I think.
It really does. In fact, when I was 14, and my mother asked me to go to the Detroit Public Library to check out Black Boy. I refused to go. Because I did not want to go to a white library and ask a white librarian for a book with Black in the title that was authored by a Black man who was critical of white America. Why did I want? I hated myself. I hated myself. But I went. I found a book on the shelf, put it to my chest, walked to an unpeopled section of the library and sat down and began to read. And every word, every sentence, paragraph, chapter was slapping me in the face and saying, wake up, Negro. Wake up, Negro. I read all day in the library, checked the book out, ran home, and finished the book in less than 24 hours. That's what art does. And that's what's missing in the lives of too many of our children. They're cutting the art programs. They're cutting the physical education program. They're going particularly towards STEM, which is fine, but you got to have the humanities in order to make people human, you see.
Amen.
One of the real problems in our community today, you're talking about the gun warfare here in Chicago and so forth, just think about this for a minute. If these young Black men actually loved themselves, actually understood who they are in the context of our history and our culture, love themselves, you don't kill yourself, and nor do you kill people who look like you, if you had this understanding. That's why our schools are African-centered schools, and they are very, very successful here in Chicago.
And very rigorous, I'm sure, too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm sure you're going to be seeing a lot of your cultural children at this conference in Dillard, I feel. We've been talking with Professor Haki Madhubuti, poet, lecturer, publisher of Third World Press. You can meet him Friday, September 9th at Dillard University. For more information and a complete schedule for the weekend, check out blackartsmovement.net. Professor Madhubuti, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, and I look forward to meeting you.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war, and poverty. Oh.
Ishmael Reed is one of the most prolific, versatile, and inventive of American writers, the author of some 30 books. The recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, as well as too many other honors to list here, he lives in California, where he is Professor Emeritus at the University of California at Berkeley, and the founder of the Before Columbus Foundation. Ishmael Reed will be here for the Black Arts Movement Conference 2016, coming up September 9th through 11th at Dillard University. Ishmael Reed, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you.
Now, Louisiana and New Orleans has been a real kind of touchstone in your work. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about your friendship with Tom Dent, who was one of our very best New Orleans writers.
Well, Tom Dent was sort of like the head of a group called the Umber Workshop. In 1963, I went to my first meeting, and since Tom Dent was connected to the civil rights movement, he worked for the NAACP, some of the well-known civil rights leaders visited our workshop, which took place in Lower East Side on East 2nd Street. Among them, Dr. King's brother and Charlene Hunter and James Meredith and a number of those celebrities visited our workshop. So there were a number of good writers, including Lorenzo Thomas and Calvin Herton, David Henderson, N.H. Pritchard, Askia Torre, who was really the philosopher of the Black Arts Movement. He's the one who converted Amiri Baraka to black nationalism. So I think a number of books have come out of that workshop. But anyway, Amiri Baraka said that the black arts movement in New York came out of the Umber Workshop.
Oh, yeah, so many great writers came out of that group. Now, New Orleans has been a kind of touchstone in your work in so many ways. You know, just look at the title, Shrovetide in Old New Orleans. In that book, you write a wonderful essay about coming to Mardi Gras and spending time with Toni Morrison and Toni Kate Bambara and Rudy Lombard and Tom Dent and Kalamu Ya Salaam. And then, of course, Mumbo Jumbo begins in New Orleans. So talk a little bit about what our city and what its kind of energy has meant to you as a writer.
I think that Catholicism over the centuries has been, well, it depends upon the pope that you get, tolerant of the practices and customs of other communities. So because of the Catholic experience and the French experience in New Orleans, a number of African customs and rites were kept intact so that you could trace some of the, what I call hoodoo, because I began with a tourist knowledge of African religion. You find traces of that in some of the rites that took place, you know, in New Orleans in the last century. So I think that you find some authentic forms of African religion, African rhythms, tribal practices in New Orleans that you don't find in other parts of the country.
When you write about New Orleans, you do have such energy and zip in your prose. Not that you don't always, but it feels so real and authentic to me. So I wonder if you'd talk a bit about why it's appropriate to be having this Black Arts Movement conference here.
Well, you could say that to many people, New Orleans is sort of like the cradle of black culture because, for example, you had Louis Armstrong and people like that. I think a great deal of jazz emerges from what Louis Armstrong did for American music and jazz. And as a matter of fact, they call swing orchestrated Armstrong. Miles Davis, a number of modern musicians, echo some of the things that Louis Armstrong did. So you had King Oliver. I collaborated with the great Alan Toussaint, one of the best moments of my career was when Alan Toussaint set some of my poems to music. One is called Skydiving. And as a matter of fact, when before Columbus had the American Book Awards in New Orleans, Alan Toussaint came and performed for us at Storyville. So there's just so much you could talk about when you talk about New Orleans. I remember being down there, and they had some kind of neighborhood meeting or a party, and some of the greatest musicians in the world were listed as performers.
And you collaborated with Leonardo Santelli as well, I think.
Yes, I did. We were on the road. We went to Tokyo together. I think I'm so much connected to New Orleans, though some down there consider me an outside agitator, that Moon Landrieu, somebody wanted to do a movie of Mumble Jumble in New Orleans. And Moon Landrieu
right.
said, well, he welcomed the crew down there because I'd been a resident of New Orleans for many years. Ex-Mayor Moon Landrieu.
Now, they've got you pretty busy over this coming weekend. You're part of a Black Studies roundtable. An excerpt from one of your plays will be performed during theater night, and you'll be on a panel discussing race in America, the Black Arts Movement now. So I wonder if you would talk about this movement a bit and what it meant to you as a young writer. You've been described as neither an advocate nor an apologist for this movement, which is an odd description to me because it doesn't seem to me to need either. But I wonder your feelings about it as you look back. Because to me, it's so interesting. There will be young writers at this conference who weren't even born when the Black Arts Movement began.
Well, I think that the significance of the Black Arts Movement, which was very much inspired by Malcolm X, I think you could say that the whole resurgence of interest in Black history, Black studies, began with the death of Malcolm X. As a matter of fact, I interviewed Bobby Seale, one of those who started the first course in Black studies, which became known as ethnic studies out here in Oakland, California. He said he was inspired by the death of Malcolm X to start a catalog or a curriculum that was adopted by the school that he was attending at the time, which is right around the corner from where I live. So we were just coming to explore African Muslim models instead of what some of the Black writers before us were imitating Western models. Which is not to deny the influence of Western models. I certainly was influenced by William Butler Yeats, Ezra Pound, Eliot, and some of the others. But we departed from that and set off into a different direction. So, for example, Askia Torre, luckily he's still around. He's probably the elder statesman of the Black Arts Movement.
And he will also be at this conference, too.
Yes, he is. Began to study Islamic influences. Kalamu Yasalam and others began to study African influences. I mean, to show the power of New Orleans and African-American culture, Kalamu has assembled 100 poets in an anthology coming out of New Orleans. But people went off into different directions. I began to study folklore. That's how I came up with Roger Tallon's Voodoo in New Orleans, which is a tourist book, all the way to beginning to study Yoruba and traveling to Nigeria and publishing writers from Nigeria. So New Orleans was where I began my aesthetic journey in trying to find a new direction. So we've set off into a new direction. Now, the significance of Black Arts, I believe, is that it began as a Black nationalist movement, but then it inspired feminist writers. It inspired multicultural writers. I say that the founding of multiculturalism begins with Umbra, because you'll notice that Jenny Lin, a Chinese-American writer, will be attending this conference.
Yes.
There are other writers like Lorna D. Cervantes, a Chicana writer, who said she was influenced by the Black Arts Movement. There's Lawson Inada, a Japanese-American writer, who says he's influenced by Black Arts. And when Black Arts or Black writers of the 1960s freed up their resources to explore the grassroots way of expressing things, this led to revolts all over the country, cultural revolts where Native Americans and others began to study their roots. So I think that the significance of Black Arts Movement is that it led to the kind of a populist, democratic notion about poetry and arts that we find today, so that arts and culture is not the preserve of an elite or the privileged, but is widespread. So I think writers can educate each other. And one would hope that this would affect the way people of different backgrounds relate to each other in everyday life, instead of learning everything about ourselves from the media.
Oh, I agree. We've been talking with poet, playwright, essayist, and novelist Ishmael Reed, who will be appearing at the Black Arts Movement Conference at Dillard University September 9th through 11th. For complete information and schedule, go to blackartsmovement.net. Ishmael, thank you so much.
No, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Ken Foster writes about many things, but he writes especially wonderfully about dogs, his own and other people's. 10 years ago, he published an amazing memoir, The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind, and it's just out in a new 10th anniversary edition. Ken Foster, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Hi, good to be back.
Well, happy birthday to your book. So tell us what's new about this edition.
Well, you know, it's kind of amazing that it's been 10 years, and I was really happy that they asked me to do some updates to the book, which include a foreword, I guess you could call it, where I talk about sort of how things have changed in 10 years, not just for me, but also for the world of animal rescue. And then I also added some discussion questions for people who might want to discuss it in a group, which was kind of fun to work on. And then, possibly most important, it has updated resources in the back, because after 10 years, even after just a few years, some of the information that I'd provided in the first edition to help people who might be interested in helping animals was very dated.
Well, and hopefully somewhat expanded, because there are so many new groups that have come into existence.
New groups, new theories of how best to address the homeless animal population, both with the foreword and with the resources. I sort of talk about how some of that stuff has changed, and particularly there's, I think, more of a recognition of trying to do outreach to communities and provide resources for people who might be struggling with caring for their pets so that their pets don't become those dogs that are either on the street or in the shelter.
Right. Now, you must be really proud to see how far this book has traveled and how it's endured over a decade.
It's what every writer, I think, hopes for, and yet, unfortunately, doesn't always click. And so, over the years, it's been amazing just to hear from readers who write to me about their own dogs or the stray dog they found who changed their life, and also to meet people who tell me that reading the book sort of inspired them to become involved in animal welfare, in volunteering, and things like that. And so it's kind of amazing to see a book, particularly a book that I wrote, have that effect on people and continue to sort of have a life years later. Mm-hmm. And I talk in the foreword also about the fact that obviously 10 years passed, the animals that I write about are no longer here. My parents, who are part of the book, are no longer here either, which makes it difficult to look back on, and yet also kind of wonderful that people continue to meet and appreciate these animals and people who were in my life.
Right. Now, this is a book that was framed by the experiences of both 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina, and here we are. We're still facing all kinds of disasters, natural and otherwise. So do you think we have better responses to pet emergencies and animal emergencies for events like that now? Do you feel hopeful, like things have made progress?
I think so. I mean, I think, unfortunately, as we recently saw in Louisiana with the flooding that no one expected, I think the response was much better. And I think people knew, wherever they were in the country, how to sort of spring into action to help both the animals and the people in that situation. You know, there were people who were rounding up supplies and hand-delivering them where they were needed and really sort of taking an initiative that I think people were sort of too stunned to take during Katrina. The people that were on the outskirts could help, didn't necessarily know where to begin.
It felt a little improved to me, I have to say.
I mean, the thing that didn't improve was that it happened at all.
Right, of course, of
and
course.
And it was another situation where, like, who would expect Baton Rouge to flood? That was
right.
Crazy.
Now, even though you've left New Orleans, and you said that you've put the work of the Sula Foundation on the back burner for a bit, which was so devoted to fostering and rescuing and educating people about pit bulls, you're still doing great work with animals at the New York City Animal Care Centers.
Sula Foundation started back in 2008 in New Orleans, and we fostered pit bulls when there was still some reluctance among other groups to do that. And we also did a lot of community outreach with low-cost vaccination clinics, free spay-neuter. And we still are doing some of that in my absence, but with less frequency because it's hard to coordinate from another part of the country. But in New York, I was offered this amazing opportunity to work full-time with the animal shelters here, providing resources to dog owners in the Bronx, which has a really high poverty rate as well as a very low number of vets even in practice up there. So people are literally unable to get their animal to a vet for regular care. And so we're doing free vaccination clinics, free spay-neuter, free dog training. We even have a pet food pantry for people who are struggling to make ends meet. And the hope is that by helping them through these tough times, which sometimes it's really just, you know, the end of the month while they're waiting for a paycheck to come, we can prevent their animals from potentially being brought to the shelter. Because sometimes people feel that's the only choice they have, and if giving them a bag of dog food can prevent that, obviously it's better for everybody involved.
Well, keep up the good work. Everybody counts on you for that. We've been talking with Ken Foster, author of The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. You can meet Ken when he signs the new edition Thursday, September 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Contributors Anne Gisselson, Anya Groner, Thomas Speller, Sarah Allison, Pia Earhart, and co-editor Mark Jakic will read from the anthology Airplane Reading, Wednesday, September 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bloodjet Poetry Series returns Wednesday, September 7th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. The featured reader this week is Izzy Onerick, who reads from and signs Crossing Brian Ferry and other poems. Today's guest, Ken Foster, discusses and signs the 10th anniversary edition of The Dogs Who Found Me, Thursday, September 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Brad Richard will lead the Maple Street Bookshop book group's discussion of A Swarm of Bees in High Court by Tanya Foster, Thursday, September 8th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Dan Yacarino signs I Am a Story, Friday, September 9th at 4:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guests, Ishmael Reed and Haki Madhubuti, appear at Black Arts Movement 2016, a conference at Dillard University, which begins Friday, September 9th at 6 at Dillard University's PSB Atrium. The Friday night celebration is free, and for more information about the rest of the schedule, check out blackartsmovement.net. Jeff J. Cruer signs America's Last Chance, Saturday, September 10th at noon at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Forest of Memory by Mary Robinette Cole, Saturday, September 10th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, September 11th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Science Fiction Book Club discusses Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke, Monday, September 12th at 6 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library present Mystery Writers Mix and Mingle, Wednesday, September 14th at 9 at Ladder Library, with writers R.L. Stein, Heather Graham, Alexander Sokoloff, Craig Robertson, Harley Jane Kozak, David Morrell, Lissa Price, Jeffrey Seeger, and Greg Heron. For tickets, visit friendsnola.org or call 910-520-4546. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading. ¶¶